Tech It For Me is an independent and solo-produced podcast.
Welcome to the Tech It For Me podcast. I'm Mike Bedell. Artificial intelligence didn't just appear with ChatGPT. It's the result of nearly a century of breakthroughs in logic, neuroscience, and computing. From Alan Turing's thought experiments to today's generative models reshaping how we work. In this episode, we're taking a journey through the real history of AI. No myths or science fiction. Just the key milestones that got us from punch cards to transformers. And along the way, I'll share how some of what I've learned through certifications in generative AI, ethics, and machine learning connects back to those foundational ideas. This is Tech It From Me. Let's go.
This is the Tech It From Me podcast.
All right, so let's set the stage here. We're in the early 20th century. The world is rebuilding after two world wars. Computing as we know it doesn't really exist yet, but the idea of machines doing complex tasks is starting to take root. The first major leap comes from Alan Turing. In 1936, years before he would help crack Nazi codes, he publishes a paper introducing the concept of a universal machine. This abstract machine could simulate any other machine's logic, and it becomes the foundation of modern computing. Today, we call it the Turing machine. Fast forward to 1950. Turing poses a question in his paper, titled Computer Machinery and Intelligence. Can machines think? To answer it, he proposes a test, what we now call the Turing test. Imagine having a text-based conversation with someone. If you couldn't tell whether it was a person or a machine, the machine would be considered intelligent. This was more than just a thought experiment. It was the first serious challenge to the idea of artificial intelligence, that machines could eventually simulate human reasoning. Around the same time, you've got people like Claude Shannon, known as the father of information theory. He laid the groundwork for how computers encode, store, and transmit information, critical for any intelligent system. He even tinkered with early chess-playing programs. Then there's John von Neumann, who gave us the modern architecture of computing, the idea that data instructions could be stored in the same memory. Without this, there would be no ChatGPT, no iPhones, no anything. So by the mid-1950s, you had the math, the theory, and the hardware, or at least the blueprints. Then came the summer of 1956, the Dartmouth Conference. This was the moment AI became its own field. John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, Nathaniel Rochester, and Claude Shannon gathered a group of researchers to explore whether every aspect of human intelligence could be described precisely enough to be simulated by a machine. They wrote in their proposal, "It is conjectured that every aspect of learning or any other feature of intelligence can, in principle, be so precisely described that a machine can be made to simulate it." That quote became the rallying cry for a new scientific discipline, artificial intelligence. Now, I want to pause here for a second because during my studies, this era was described as being equal parts genius and hubris. The researchers were incredibly smart, but also incredibly optimistic. They thought human-level AI was 20 years away. Spoiler alert, it wasn't. Still, what they set in motion at Dartmouth would echo through every generation of computer science that followed. And that's where this story really begins on AI. So after the Dartmouth conference, researchers got to work. The late 1950s and 60s were full of promise and honestly some pretty impressive early wins, given the limited computing power of the time. Let's start with the logic theorist, developed in 1956 by Alan Newell and Herbert Simon at RAND Corporation. This program could prove mathematical theorems from Principia Mathematica, and even found a more elegant proof than the original authors. That was a big deal. It showed that machines could reason, at least in narrow, rule-based domains. Then there was ELIZA, built by Joseph Weizenbaum at MIT in 1966. ELIZA was an early natural language processing program that simulated a Rogerian psychotherapist. It used pattern matching and substitution to respond to users' input in a way that felt conversational. So here's an example. User, I'm feeling anxious about work. Eliza would respond, why do you say you're feeling anxious about work? It was simple, almost mechanical, but it created the illusion of understanding. People became emotionally attached to it. Weizenbaum was actually disturbed by this. He intended Eliza as a parody, not a therapist, but people poured their hearts out to it. This was one of the earliest ethical red flags in AI, a reminder that just because something sounds intelligent doesn't mean it necessarily is. Same could be said about some humans today, but I digress. And this theme, user perception versus actual intelligence, is still relevant today, especially with tools like ChatGPT. Now, despite these early examples, the reality behind the scenes was clunky, to say the least. These systems worked well in controlled environments, but they couldn't deal with ambiguity, nuance, or real-world variability. Take machine translation, for example. In the 1960s, the US government heavily funded programs to translate Russian into English. They hoped to decode Cold War intelligence faster. But the results were laughably bad. There's a famous example where, in quotes, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, end quote. This was translated to Russian and then back again, and it came out as, the vodka is good, but the meat is rotten. Expectations were far ahead of what the reality actually was. By the early 1970s, the honeymoon was really over. Governments realized that AI wasn't delivering on its promises, so funding was cut and projects were shelved. And that brings us to what's now called the first AI winter, a period of deep skepticism, limited progress, and reduced investment. From a business and policy standpoint, AI was seen as overhyped. From a technical standpoint, the tools just weren't ready yet. Computers were still too slow, storage was limited, and models simply couldn't scale. The biggest mistake of this era wasn't technical, it was narrative. The field overpromised and underdelivered. And when you lose trust, whether with funders, users, or the public, you don't just lose momentum, you lose credibility. And that's a lesson we're still learning today. But here's the thing about winters. They don't last forever. And AI, as a field, it wasn't dead. It was simply regrouping, waiting for that next spark. And a spark came in the form of a very different approach. Coming out of that first AI winter, the 1980s brought a new approach to artificial intelligence, one that looked less like mimicking the human brain and more like mimicking human expertise. This was the rise of expert systems. Unlike earlier attempts to recreate general intelligence, expert systems focused on narrowly defined problems. The concept was straightforward. Take the knowledge of a domain expert, such as a doctor or a mechanic, and encode it as a set of rules the computer could follow. And for a while, this approach worked. One of the most famous systems was MYCIN, developed at Stanford. MYCIN, spelled M-Y-C-I-N, diagnosed bacterial infections and recommended treatments. In controlled tests, it even outperformed junior doctors. But despite the accuracy, MYCIN was never deployed in real hospitals. You might ask why, and the answer is quite simple. It couldn't explain its reasoning in plain language. And when it comes to life and death decisions, people need to understand why the machine made its recommendation. That lack of transparency created a trust gap, and that's something we still deal with today in AI systems, particularly when decisions affect people's health, finances, or legal outcomes. Despite this, expert systems caught on in the corporate world. Companies like American Express and Digital Equipment Corporation invested in internal tools for credit scoring, troubleshooting, and support. The logic was appealing. Capture what your best people know and use it to scale decision making. But expert systems had a critical flaw. They didn't learn. Every rule had to be programmed by hand. If the world changed, say fraud tactics evolved or new regulations came in, someone had to update the rules. They were only as smart as the last time someone told them what to do. As complexity grew, maintaining these rule-based systems became a burden. They couldn't adapt, they couldn't generalize, and they couldn't improve on their own. By the late 1980s, companies started abandoning them. The second AI winter had begun. This one hit harder, though. Businesses had poured real money into expert systems. Expectations were higher, and when those systems couldn't keep up, budgets were slashed and reputations were ultimately damaged. But there was a silver lining. Expert systems taught us a lot about how humans reason under constraints, and about the importance of explainability, maintenance, and scale. They also made one thing clear. If AI was going to survive and grow, it had to move beyond fixed rules. It had to start learning. Coming out of the second AI winter, the field of artificial intelligence found its footing again, but this time with a different mindset. Instead of trying to teach machines how to think like humans using hard-coded rules, researchers started asking, what if we let machines learn from examples? This was the rise of machine learning, and it marked a major pivot. The difference is simple, but profound. Expert systems are programmed, meaning someone tells them exactly what to do. Machine learning models are trained. They learn patterns from data. Rather than defining what a cat looks like in code, you feed the system thousands of cat and non-cat images, and it figures out the patterns that distinguish one from the other. This idea wasn't new. It dated back to early neural networks in the 1950s. But back then, we didn't have the data or the computing power to make it practical. By the 1990s and 2000s, that had changed. Three things came together. One, more data. Thanks to the internet and digital sensors, we had access to massive data sets. Number two, better algorithms. New techniques like support vector machines and random forests improved accuracy. And number three, faster computing. More powerful processors made training models faster and more affordable. Machine learning started quietly transforming industries. Email providers used it for spam detection. Banks applied it to detect credit card fraud. And retailers optimized recommendation engines. So one great example? Spam filters. In the early days, filters looked for specific keywords. But spammers adapted quickly. Machine learning systems, however, could adapt just as fast, spotting subtle patterns that weren't obvious to humans. The same thing happened in finance. Traditional fraud rules flagged fixed dollar amounts. Machine learning models flagged behavioral anomalies, like a sudden transaction in a country you've never visited. This wasn't just automation, it was adaptation, and it was quite powerful. For most of us, this was the era where AI started quietly working in the background, shaping search engines, social media feeds, and even how we shop. And while machine learning made AI useful again, the real revolution was still ahead. Because what if machines could not just learn from data, but learn in layers and extract meaning from complex inputs like images, speech, and language? That's what brought us into the next phase, deep learning. By the early 2010s, machine learning had made AI practical again, but it still had limits. Many models needed human assistance to identify which features mattered. If you were building a model to identify cats in images, for example, a data scientist still had to define things like pointy ears or whiskers. That's known as feature engineering, and it was time-consuming and inflexible. But what if a system could learn those features on its own? That's where deep learning changed the game. Deep learning is a subset of machine learning that uses neural networks with many layers, hence the word deep. Each layer processes the data at a different level of abstraction. The first might detect edges in a photo, the next shapes, then eyes, then entire faces, it builds understanding as it moves deeper. These architectures were inspired by how we think the human brain works, but for years they didn't work well in practice. The training took too long, the results weren't better than other methods. Then came 2012. A deep learning model called AlexNet entered the ImageNet competition, a benchmark for image classification. It dramatically outperformed everything else, cutting the error rate by nearly half. Why was AlexNet such a big deal? Because it showed deep learning could outperform traditional models, if you had the right ingredients. Those ingredients were large data sets, GPU acceleration, and improved training techniques like ReLU, activations, and dropout. The ImageNet win was a turning point. Suddenly, deep learning wasn't just theoretical. It was state-of-the-art. And companies noticed. Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, they all began building deep learning into their products. AI could now identify faces and objects in photos, transcribe and understand speech, translate languages in real time, drive cars, detect tumors, recommend content. In marketing, deep learning models started to write personalized ad copy, predict campaign performance, generate branded visuals based on product descriptions. And for the first time, AI could handle unstructured data, images, video, audio, and natural language just as easily as structured numbers in a spreadsheet. But deep learning came with a cost, and that was explainability. These models were accurate, but they were also opaque. You couldn't always trace why they made a certain decision. Even today, we often refer to them as black boxes. It's a big problem in high-stakes domains like healthcare, finance, and law. It's also part of a broader conversation we're still having today. How do we balance capability with control? Still, the success of deep learning set the stage for the next and current phase of AI's evolution. Because if deep learning gave AI the power to see and hear, what came next gave it the power to understand and communicate. That being, transformers. In 2017, a paper titled "Attention is All You Need" was published by researchers at Google. With it came a brand new architecture called the Transformer, and it fundamentally changed the trajectory of AI. Up until then, most models dealing with language relied on recurrent neural networks, or RNNs, which processed language sequentially one word at a time. That meant training was slow, and these models struggled to retain context over long passages. Transformers flipped that approach on its head. Instead of processing words one after another, they used a mechanism called self-attention, which allowed the model to look at all the words in a sentence, or even an entire paragraph, simultaneously and understand the relationships between them. So let's look at an example. The cat sat on the mat because it was tired. A transformer-based model can figure out that the word "it" refers to the cat and not the mat, because it considers the full sentence at once. This ability to model relationships across long text makes transformers incredibly good at understanding meaning and context. This architecture became the foundation for modern AI language models. BERT, developed by Google, GPT, developed by OpenAI, and dozens of others from Meta, Anthropic, Mistral, and more. In 2020, OpenAI released GPT-3 with 175 billion parameters, a model capable of writing essays, summarizing content, translating languages, and even generating code. But it wasn't until late 2022, when ChatGPT made GPT-3.5 publicly accessible, that the world truly took notice. Suddenly, anyone, not just developers or researchers, could chat with an AI that sounded almost human. We entered the era of generative AI. And with it came a tidal wave of real-world applications. Automated writing for blogs, ads, and emails, content summarization, and meeting notes, AI assistants embedded into search engines and productivity software, image generation from text prompts, voice cloning, video generation, and more. Generative AI quickly became a part of the everyday toolkit, not just for tech professionals, but for marketers, students, writers, and small businesses. But with all this capability came new questions. How do we know when an AI is hallucinating or making things up? What happens when biases from training data show up in outputs? Who owns AI-generated content? These questions aren't just philosophical, they're practical and they're urgent. And while the promise of these tools is massive, so are the risks. That's why the conversation is shifting from what can AI do to what should it do, and how do we build in accountability? Because whether it's writing a press release, designing a logo, or giving business advice, AI is no longer just in the background. It's sitting in the room with us. So over the last 20 minutes, we've covered how we got here. Now let's talk about what's next. We're living in a moment where AI is evolving rapidly, and the road ahead could go in a few different directions. But most of the conversation today centers around two major trajectories. Path one is a smarter, broader AI. This path we're already on, building smarter, more capable, and more integrated AI tools. We're seeing language models that don't just generate text, they can interpret images. They can write code, analyze video, and connect across different types of input. These represent the next leap in general usability. Companies are embedding these models into everyday software. Microsoft's Copilot in Word, Excel, and Teams. Google's Gemini in Docs and Gmail. Salesforce's Einstein GPT for customer service. AI is becoming a layer, something that enhances almost every digital experience. There's also a growing ecosystem of open source models like Meta's Llama or Mistral, which are smaller, more customizable, and available to developers and researchers around the world. This is really powerful, but it also makes regulation harder because now anyone can build powerful AI tools with fewer restrictions or oversight. The second path is toward artificial general intelligence, or AGI. This one's more speculative, but also more ambitious. It's the pursuit of artificial general intelligence, or AGI, an AI that can reason, learn, and apply knowledge across any task the way a human can. Some leading AI labs like OpenAI and DeepMind believe AGI is possible within the next decade. Others are more cautious, arguing that while models like GPT are impressive, they still rely on pattern prediction and not true understanding. And there's a third group, ethicists, researchers, and policy advocates, focused on making sure that regardless of the outcome, we don't lose control of the systems we're building. These folks talk about alignment, interpretability, and safety, and their concern is this. Even narrow AI, if deployed at scale and without oversight, can have unintended or catastrophic consequences. From job displacement to misinformation to deepfakes, the risks aren't just theoretical anymore. They're already here. That's why governments around the world are now stepping in. The European Union has passed the world's first AI law. Canada, the US, and others are drafting policy frameworks. But regulation alone won't solve everything. What we really need are more people in business, in education, and in public life who understand both what AI is and what it isn't. Because AI isn't just a technical challenge. It's an economic one, it's a social one, it's a human one. And the more voices we have at the table, the better chance we have of guiding it towards something that truly benefits everyone. So here's my take. We've gone from rule-based systems to machine learning to generative models that can write, draw, and interact. It's an incredible arc. But every leap in capability comes with new blind spots. So we look ahead. Let's not just chase what's possible. Let's focus on what's responsible. The future of AI isn't just about what we build. It's about what we choose to build and why. Thanks for listening and coming along on this journey through the history of artificial intelligence. If this episode sparked a new insight, helped you connect some dots, or gave you something to think about, consider sharing it with someone else who might enjoy it. You can follow Tech It From Me on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you got some feedback or simply just want to say hello, I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line at inspire@techitforme.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Madol.
This is the Tech It From Me podcast.